Thank you very much. Can we shut the door, please? Can I make sure that the secretariat is here at 15 minutes before our session begin, please? Mr. Flander, can you make sure the secretariat, all of the secretariat is here 15 minutes before our time to begin? May I, on behalf of National Assembly and this ad hoc committee, welcome the mass rally, sorry, the delegation from the Independent Election Commission, Dr. Begelia Baum, Advocate Fancy Nakula, Mr. Zulise Mafuya, Chief Financial Officer, Masoja Mutia, Deputy Chief Electoral Officer, Norman Duplessis, Deputy Chief Electoral Officer, Ms. Fanny van Merwe, Commissioner, Ms. Toko Mpulwana, Commissioner. We know many of you. If I left out any name, if you can, the chair can correct that. Now, you have succeeded in doing something which my closest people, as my doctor and my spouse, failed to do. And that is, you got me out of my sick bed to come here then. Now, there has to be payback for this. Can you now tell us, off the record, whether you're seeking a special budgetary allocation from the Treasury so that next year you will not supervise the election, but you will run the presidential election in the United States next year? Especially in Florida, where they started a new machine system where 8,000 votes disappear through the House of Representatives elections. Now, Dr. Baum, could you just tell us, yes or no, whether you're seeking a supplementary provision from the Treasury?
No,
sir. Ah, sure. Well, now, there's no payback for him. Can I welcome you then? You see, we start on time, but there are people attending other meetings starting at 9 o'clock here. So, and there's a very important meeting at 10 o'clock. And we have this problem in Parliament that although this committee has priority, there are people who seek permission to attend. Let me explain what this process is about. Public relations people call it an interactive encounter, but this is not an interactive encounter. It's neither a love fest nor a beauty contest. This is an attempt and it's not an inquisition. It's an attempt by the National Assembly 10, 12 years after our freedom to try to evaluate the functioning of Chapter 9 bodies. We call them Chapter 9, some of them are Chapter 10, some of them are Chapter 1, some are not even there. We added them to Chapter 1, which we'll come to. To evaluate the efficiency, the efficacy, the relevance, to identify some issues, maybe common to them, while we recognize that nearly every one of the bodies is different from the other, either in their mandate or in their powers or their functions. You may be able to group some of them together, but the Independent Electoral Commission, the Auditor General, Public Protector have a special function. You, of course, established very early, notwithstanding Home Affairs, that you're not a supervisory body, that you have executive functions, administrative functions. That is very important. And thank you for bringing to our attention what I call the Stillby case, the case where there was an allegation attempt that you were a body that was an organ of state, but you're not an organ of state, which I tried to persuade one of the other Chapter 9 bodies that it was not an organ of state, but here you have a constitutional court's prescription that you're not part of cooperative governance, you're independent of that. So thank you for bringing it to our attention too. And so therefore, what we try to do is to send to all what I call broadly bodies that support democracy an identical questionnaire. And I must compliment you not only the blind, the questionnaire, but the box full of material which we have put in the library, which I'm sure the researchers will be looking at very carefully, enormous amount of material, and the quality of your response, and particularly the candidness of your annual report for last year. Many of us have been involved in the election process and setting up of the IEC, but we'll be asking you questions by reference to the 25 responses, but also the terms of reference. All your responses, we should try to look at the terms of reference which we supplied you with. And so, what we also try to do to assist the committee and to assist the chairperson primarily is to ask each member of the committee to take two of the 11 bodies and to lead the questions. But every member of the committee, of course, is equal member. You notice, by the way, this is not a party political committee. There's equality between the government and the non-government parties in Parliament. Oh, sorry, in the National Assembly. I'm very careful. This is National Assembly Committee, not a parliamentary committee. Largely because Chapter 9 bodies are accountable to the National Assembly. So I've asked two people, we've asked two people to look at this in a more systematic way. We are all aware of the fact that the foundation of democratic order depends on the nature of the election process, the fairness, the openness, and I must say the efficiency of the election process. We are very conscious of that. So if we ask you very searching questions, not to micromanage you, asking by reference to what terms of reference it is. Right? You have not said in your annual report, unfortunately, that when the election results were announced in last year, and local government and all the political parties voted confidence in you and for your fairness and the way you dealt with all the complaints. I thought you might say that, you know, with a photograph of all the 29 political parties congratulating you. There's very few photographs also in your annual report, which I must commend you on, by the way. So we'll be asking very searching questions, allows you to draw out from your replies, mostly to look at the material you sent us to us, which will relate to that. So, people we've asked is Jane Matsumola, you know, and when we see Dr. Delport also, the two people. I'll ask the first question, that's my prerogative. The first question is your constitutional and legal status and order. That's the first question. But nowhere in the Constitution or in the legislation is your name described as the Independent Electoral Commission. Can you answer that? Why you put the adjective when the Constitution does not describe you? It describes the commission on this, the commission on that. That's what the legislation says. But the legislation of 1996 and the amendments don't refer to the Independent Electoral Commission. Could you assist these illiterates who make up the committee as to why you've suddenly arrogated this Independent Electoral Commission?
Thank you very much for welcoming us. With your permission, we thought on our side we will try and take a collective responsibility of answering these questions.
I'm not well. This report you have is the report of the commission, is it?
Yes.
It's a commission has discussed the report, yes. And it's a joint report. Yes. It's not always so. That's why, for the record, it's a joint report. Sorry, yes, go on.
It's a joint report. In fact, I have to tell you, this has been, in some ways, extremely helpful to us because these questions gave us an opportunity to look at the review that we are doing ourselves. We are reviewing the Electoral Commission, as it is named in the Constitution. We'll explain why we put the word independent just now. And we,
That's part of the question. Sorry.
Yes.
Explain that and then we can go on.
Okay. I think according to that, that is correct. Maybe one of my... Let me just explain that, though. This is not my responsibility to deal with the Constitution. When we met after 1994, we felt that the independent was a very popular slogan that we wanted to use, and it had branded very, very well, and it had made us a lot of gains from the public, and there was a lot of enthusiasm about the establishment of this independence. And we also experienced that the parties liked this very, very much, this emphasis on independence. And so on the advice of, at that time, our chairperson, Judge Crickler, we discussed it and we said, no, we will remain referring to ourselves as an electoral commission. But for the purposes of branding, it was very important that, and also the purposes of giving the confidence to people of our independence. And so, in fact, we use it. And we have also noticed that a lot of other electoral commissions around Africa especially are all now referring to themselves as independent, except for the United Kingdom one. They haven't used very much of that. Yes. So that is really the response to that. So we use it really more. On some documents we do try to stick to using the word electoral commission. But the popular phrase now, it has become the IEC.
We love that, and when we make a report we say the first opportunity we have, that the proper description should be the independent electoral commission.
Okay.
Chief Executive Officer.
Thank you, Chairperson, and good morning to all members. But I think if on all our official documents, you will notice that we use the correct appellation. So we use IEC for branding purposes, but not in official documents. Thank you.
I had to ask that, right. So, we in our report, in the appropriate place, the amendment should be made, because it's very important that the adjective should be there. It's an oversight, because there have been so many amendments. There have been 5 or 6, 7 or 8 amendments that have been done. Now, Mrs. Matsumono.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Section 5 of the Electoral Commission Act expands the duties of the IEC and functions to include 15 additional ones. Now, one of them is to undertake and promote research in electoral matters. So, with your permission, Chair, if I could just ask 2 questions on this one, just to allow them to give a comprehensive answer. Could you please indicate key electoral matters that require research since the IEC's existence? You know, this is a new experience for us, and I'm sure we are learning a lot from what we are doing. And secondly, please provide an idea of whether such research has resolved or enlightened us about such electoral matters. Thank you.
Thank you. Sorry, I've been across.
Are we just getting used to the contending?
Forgive us a little bit. Who is going to answer that question? Because it falls under which section? I'm referring to our team. Is there anyone in our team who wants to make reference to that? Otherwise, I'll...
In addition to that, you spent $4.79 million research in 2006. While you're looking at this, can you provide details of the research done on commission? We'll pass that, we'll be noted, and we'll come back after tea, and we can have the answer. We did tell you we are going through a very, very intentioned, detailed question. We're dealing now with the role and function of the institution.
Okay,
yes,
okay.
Thank you, Jane.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Chair. Now, we're still on the function. With regard to your function to develop and promote the development of electoral expertise and technology in all spheres of governance, we are aware of the voter education program
in a large number of schools that we are doing. But now, could you enlighten us on the next level of developing electoral expertise and the technology? Because my understanding is that this means taking voter education a further step, you know, a bit forward to deepen democracy. So if you could just enlighten us on the next level. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I'll attempt to respond to that question, but to preface it by saying that maybe this is one of the areas that we still have to work on. To say that we have indeed developed electoral expertise in other spheres of government. Because, one, in conducting elections, we work with the Department of Education. Most of our presiding officers and deputy presiding officers are teachers and school principals. We have professionalized our training of electoral officials. We have registered 9 unit standards in election management. So among, you know, teachers and principals, educators, we have developed a cadet, a pool of election management specialists. At local government level as well, we have developed those expertise because we conduct our elections in collaboration with local government, because our municipal electoral officers by and large are municipal managers. So even at that level, we have developed those skills. We are a small organization, full-time people who work for this organization aren't many, and we have always recognize the fact that we will have to run elections in this country in collaboration and in conjunction with other people in the public service. So at least at that level, we have developed those expertise. I must also say that at Department of Home Affairs as well, you know, because we work very closely with them when we compile and maintain the voters' roll. As you know, we have to run our voters' roll against the population register, which means that there has to be technical teams. We have technical teams between the IEC and the Department of Home Affairs so that we can sanitize and clean up the voters' roll. So even at that level, Home Affairs understands our business, and also our IT systems are linked and they talk to each other.
On this precise point, could you, must we deduce from your answer so far that the IEC has not looked at electronic voting, the latest in technological systems? I do remember that we looked at some Heath Robinson thing, which was the latest technology in years ago when you started out. But does this imply that you haven't considered looking at electronic voting systems under either research or the other matter that Ms. Foster raised, the development of technology?
Not really. What we have done is to try and witness the usage in other countries of these machines. We sent 2 people some years to go to India, because India has been using the electronic technology for a long time, and the colleagues came back, and at that time we were in a process of just trying to develop our own systems, and we were having particular problems at that time in South Africa on how we handle our own registration processes in technology of that, which was at the time our major focus, and also issues for us at the time of delimitation and boundaries. And we felt we were not ready. Then we looked at the United States. We went there. I was part of the group that went to Florida myself. And it became clear as we were there in assessment that we will need in South Africa to coin our own, which would have implications in our context of even the delimitation process in order to fit it. And then to be able also to develop the Indian one, or the ones where they use batteries and things like that. So we felt this time round, as we are now doing our own review in general in the office related to looking at our systems, ITs and others, this is one of the things we ourselves will be looking at much more closely. Where we can, without electrification, because there were also hopes that maybe by year 2007, most parts of South Africa, if not all, will be electrified, and it would lessen the usage of batteries in the rural area. So maybe we are ready now to really move into it and see what other forms we can coin, suiting our situation of electricity in particular.
I just spent a weekend in Ireland, and there were, it's a population of 4 million, very homogeneous, very integrated. Mm-hmm. Some civil servants induced the minister of local government to order an electronic system, cost them 25 million euros. After one look at it, they spent the 25 million euros, which is something like 200 million rand, and they've turned it down. The system's been turned down. They go back to the manual one. So thank you very much. We dispose of that. Jane?
Two of my colleagues would like to add to that.
Chairman, if you'll just allow me on the question of development of electricity.
No. It doesn't arise. That's for the portfolio committee to deal with. Huh? I think the chairperson gave an answer. You're considering the matter. Huh? That's enough for us.
Thank you, Chairman. In response to our question 6, we note the use of an internal project evaluation system. We refer to it as the project charter system. Could you just explain how this works? Does it involve all the people within the organization, or does it involve people at certain levels? How does it add value to the whole electoral system? In a nutshell, how effective is this system? Thank you.
Yes, thank you very much. I think we use the project management system to evaluate our project. We start first by developing our strategic objectives, and then our strategic objectives will have clear indicators and measurable outcomes. Then I'm looking for the correct word. We capture our project in the project management system. That system will contain all the projects of the organization, and the system is available to all members of staff. What the project, the PCS does, it helps us to monitor the implementation of each and every project at each and every stage. It also helps us to monitor our spending patterns to ensure that, to monitor whether each department spends the money that has been allocated to it for that particular project. So it's really a system that works very, very well for us, and we've been able to use it to our benefit, and we use it throughout the year. Once we have developed our strategic objectives, as we have done now, we're now going to go back to our project charter system, and we're going to capture all our projects, and each and every senior manager who reports monthly to the chief electoral officer reports on the progress towards the implementation of the project in the PCS.
Use that for budgeting purposes when you come later, isn't it?
Yes.
Budget management. Before we end this first part,
we have to establish the legality of activities. You say, and you help on that page of 78, other institutions, taxi organization, SRC, elections. Provide, then page 8 and 9, you provide technical, managerial, logistical assistance, electoral committee, other countries. Mm-hmm. These are other bodies. Now, this is a very laudable work. What's the legal basis for this? Doesn't say lay down in your objects and acts. What's the legal basis for doing very laudable work? But, you know, we have to look at the question of efficient use of money, too. Now, so can you answer this question as to should we amend the legislation or leave it to the Human Rights Commission and support democracy to be doing this work? The first part is helping internal bodies, taxis, unions, and the elections and all. Second part is assistance outside. But can you just tell us about the legal basis, advocate, since you are the lawyer?
There is no legal basis. They can't. The law says we manage elections at local, provincial and national level. However, if we look at our mandate, it also says we can promote electoral democracy. And under that, we have interpreted that mandate broadly to assist these organizations with deepening democracy internally within their structure.
All terms of reference have to be interpreted. Depends on the amplitude of the breadth of the interpretation. We'll note that. Because we'll come back to the other aspects about money too, you see. Yes, Ms. Johnson.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just going from the previous question, I also see that in the new academy, with the Center for Elections Learning, that we're training a lot of election officers from other countries as well. So do you see your role increasing on the continent?
I must say, I think I'm saying right, we didn't realize, we never realized we would be so involved in working in Africa. It was never the plan. And a lot of these requests have come directly from electoral commissions themselves, and they have all, some of them have come, quite a lot of them, from the Foreign Affairs Department, related on foreign policy. And we have been discussing ourselves on looking and strengthening the legality of the work that we do outside South Africa because of the volumes suddenly we have, especially with the DRC. And all the work that was used for instance, the DRC and the Comoros, is that the money is not in our budget. It comes from the Foreign Affairs, but we still use our staff time to do this work overseas. So those are things we have been talking about ourselves, whether in fact we don't need to tighten this up a little bit. And yesterday this was a reference also of the Portfolio Committee on establishing policies of accounting also for the money, because they give us the money, but the money was not in our budget. It's not reflected. It's reflected in their budget. So we're beginning to look now, because this has new implications on us international, what it means, and for us also, our staff having to work with the staff of the United Nations, we are on different policies on this, the way the United Nations work with our staff, the remuneration they give, and the protection they give to their staff, and insurances, which we hadn't moved into those areas. It's a new area for us. So we are now also encouraged also by the Foreign Affairs looking at this, and encouraged also by the our own committee yesterday on this.
Can we just pause a bit? Because the question I was going to ask a little later, after 12 o'clock, was, is there an agreement, a kind of aid memoir with Foreign Affairs covering this area of insurance, accidents, death, compensation? Is there an agreement? Because they are South African citizens. I mean, the Irish government gave a lot of money for the Congo because of you, because of the confidence they had. They gave those millions of rands. But if confidence can't be misplaced. So the short question is, which will be necessary for us, about the efficient conduct of your business, is there an aid memoir, an agreement between Foreign Affairs and you? And what discussion do you have to turn down the requests? Well, not every request can be undertaken. Some of the requests have taken place 3 months before our general election. You have discretion. We all like to be helping fellow African countries, right? Although Comoros, yes, it is an African country too. But is there a memorandum of understanding? On what basis do you send, and you have been wonderful, because you have a list of the people here, the list of the people who have gone on these work. Have you given assurance to the families that they'll be covered by rates and by United Nations rates and all compensation? Short answer.
Thank you, Chair. There is an agreement. We do enter into an agreement with Foreign Affairs, and in instances where Foreign Affairs will work very closely with bodies such as the United Nations. It does cover the issues pertaining to how our staff will be treated overseas. For example, giving them diplomatic status or UN status working in a foreign country, and all the benefits that will accrue to United Nations members working in that country.
Sure. I think you best not manage this because it comes into reference. Can we have a copy of that agreement? That's the best thing. It's not only insurance, only there are whole kinds of other things: repatriation, medical assistance. Now, so in other words, this agreement is only about, but there's no overall agreement to say what discussion you have and so we won't touch on this. Yeah, I was going to ask you this after midday on that. Jane, we'll come back to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. In response to question 7, with regards to evaluating success with which you are carrying out your functions, we note the use of the debriefing of staff at national, provincial, and local level. We also note the emphasis placed on the HSRC survey to determine needs and attitudes of voters. These are used then to determine your strategic objectives, to plan elections, and for budget requirements. But now, could you isolate any key challenges for future elections that have been identified through these methods?
Because you have covered the areas of debriefing with you, but I think some of the challenges which we didn't identify here that has come through special votes are a special challenge to us in this country, and that is one of the areas we are looking at, because we have no provision for special votes for local government. It is almost for now impossible, the way we are structured, to be able to meet people for local government elections. There are provisions that we have, as you know, for people who have special disabilities and problems, and you know all about our debates on people voting who are residing abroad. I will not go into that. And that is one very, very special problem that we face. The second problem we still face is related precisely to entrenching democracy. I'm not talking just of the electoral democracy, enriching communities in South Africa where we have very high rate of illiteracy. Because our publications, it's a written word, you must be able to read, and that is it. And we translate our materials into the languages that South Africans read. But then whether in fact those materials are able to reach people of the rural communities on this figure, it's not just only how to vote, which is most South Africans, we hope, at least now understand why they have to vote. And that remains a challenge. The third one, which is still there for us, is the infrastructure of the country. We hope with improvement of schools, you know, we still have schools, unfortunately, which you know we use. We use schools in most parts of South Africa. I think we use, if I'm right, 65% schools for purposes. There are still schools that do not have water, no sanitation, and rather in poor condition. And sometimes people have to be in the schools, you know, for long lines. And those are some of the problems that make it very hard for voters. Still, distances for travel is a reality, in spite of the fact that most people try now to use their own transport to organize themselves. So we do have some of those problems that have come through. And I think that the understanding of the electoral laws across the board, even by political parties, are a problem. This has been one of the greatest challenges for us, which is demonstrated sometimes when we were taken to court, that our, besides our lawyers, of course, you know, with your apologies to the lawyers who are here, they interpret some of these laws differently. I think the intra-party tensions have also been quite a challenge to us, especially in our local government elections. You know, the democracy within parties, and I think we can go into detail on the candidates, appointment of candidates, procedures that are followed, whether everybody understands them. An example of that is that last year for local government, we disqualified, do we use the word disqualified? 982 candidates coming from parties, and so parties, of course, get very angry with us why we have removed the people. And so there are those problems that they don't only come from the formal research, but they also come when we have these briefing sessions on the discussion after the elections, and those are the things that come through to us where we have to look at changes.
Function, the final question here is this question of voter registration. Well, that's part of our efficiency. You say, one deliverable is what you say on page 17, increase of almost 2 million registered voters is 3,000. But there has been an increase in the percentage of voters. Has there been an increase in the percentage of voters? Which would be the total number of eligible voters? Associated with this is this, you see, you say part of your purpose is the extended democracy. Why are you not more aggressive in saying that, for example, the number of people registered in South Africa far exceeds that number in comparable democracies, mature ones? Secondly, that our voting of 70% far exceeds most democracies. It's astounding. You see, newspapers bear terrible burden of history. It's part of their own negligence. But they don't know what happens in other countries. What do you compare South Africa? Local government elections vote at 49%. In the United Kingdom, the vote is about 33%. In the United States, it's 25%. Right? Now, other countries, the figures are not manageable. Now, in the general election in Britain, 2 years ago, it was 65%. Now, why are you not more aggressive in strengthening democracy by saying our registration vote is higher? In the United States, 52% of the eligible people in the United States are registered. 52%. How is this? You tell us now. You say it's gone up by 2 million. What about the percentage, Mr. Duplessis, of the eligible voters? What percentage is that? And secondly, to both the chief officer and the chairman, why are we not more aggressive in saying that our democracy is working, rather than the newspaper things, which says that there'll be a very low vote, and therefore destabilized? Why are we not more aggressive about this? Now, first one is about 2 million. What's the percentage in relation to
JSB? The big debate there is about how many people we are in this country, and I don't think there's obviously a census, and it's got an official figure, but there's a lot of disagreement in various sectors of government on that particular one. I think if you look at the death rate and the addition of new voters, that it is remained at the percentage more or less that. We estimate in terms of having gone to all of the areas in the country, three times since 2004 where statistically, in terms of the census, we have a less than 50% of registered voters. We've done a door-to-door campaign, and by and large, we have not found the numbers that statistically there should be. Our estimate is that about 83% of the eligible population is registered at this point in time. Having said that, that is also based on, if you look at the census, it indicates that there's something like 100,000 non-South African citizen adults in the country. So I think there is also an area, and it may in fact be higher than the 83%, and that there may be confusion on citizenship of people, and that people are counted as South African citizens and are not that. If you compare this, in old Europe, I think, where you have re-established systems, registration rates are higher. Whether that translates into a vote is another matter. But if you compare us with Australia, if you compare us with Mexico, countries like that, then Australia is in fact slightly behind us. They're about 80-81%. Although it is legally compulsory to register, yes.
They have compulsory voting, therefore there's legal obligation to register, isn't
that? That is correct. And in our particular instance, we've not considered that rebellion simply because it's a democratic right. You either not or to register. But we compare more than favorably. I think the registration methodology that we follow when an election comes up contributes to that greatly, because you can get the hype that actually brings people out.
I asked this of my friend in two parties. I said, why do we have to go around every 3 years getting voter registration now? And the answer was that when you spend those 3 or 4 days, it's more successful than the whole year open office you have them in the municipalities. And concentrated 3 days one is more successful than any other activity. Is that correct? I mean, these are two major parties in South Africa I consulted. And they said those 3 days activities are seen. Is that correct? What? Your body language says yes.
It is correct. That is why we invest a lot of time and energy in that methodology. But to come back to your question, why haven't we publicized the fact that most of the eligible voters are registered in this country? It's probably African modesty.
There's a place for modesty. I see the press has left by now. Well, that's a real problem, isn't that so? They don't wish to hear good luck stories, isn't that so? They don't want to. They want to.
Everybody wants good news.
Well, this is good news, but they don't publish it. Thank you. We'll move on to the next question.
On the registration of youth, our young people, was that a disappointment?
It was a huge success. Yes, we had about 53% of new registrations were young people between 18 and 35, and that was because of the Power of X campaign that was led and was developed by young people, led by young people. So it was a very successful campaign.
Yes. That's you. Yes.
Would it be correct to say in that very campaign the Youth Commission complimented the efforts of the IEP successfully in getting young people registered?
Would you come to this in relation to other bodies? Would you like to expand on that experience you have? But I mean, Youth Council you mentioned in your report also. Youth Council, South African National Youth Council, the Commission. Would you like to expand what kind of fruitful collaboration you have?
He asked a specific question about the Youth Commission. Shouldn't he answer that first?
Yes, no, we work very closely with the Youth Commission. In fact, they even initiated a meeting that we had with them before the elections to say how can we help you to ensure that young people will register and vote. So we had initial small meetings with them. Then after that, we had a bigger meeting where they were there together with the youth council. I must emphasize that, in fact, on this issue, the Youth Commission plays a very important part, and they usually initiate discussions with us.
You mentioned Youth Council in your report.
Yes,
The Youth Council also came. We had a big workshop and seminar with all the youth formations in this country to together think how we're going to enthuse and encourage young people to participate in the electoral process, and not only as voters, also as electoral staff, to say how many young people are we going to train and appoint in voting stations to help us to conduct elections.
Yes, we have already moved on to the relationships with other bodies. Now, in response to question 10 regarding the oversight role of Parliament over your institutions, you have indicated that you interact with several portfolio committees, SCOPA, Home Affairs, Provincial and Local Government, and Foreign Affairs, and you have noted some problems in the Parliament's oversight mechanism. You are saying a holistic understanding of the work of Chapter 9 institutions is lacking by portfolio committees of Parliament, and you actually propose that an oversight mechanism that has greater integration of Chapter 9 institutions reporting is needed. Now, in the light of this, I would like to ask you, because I know you have said that Parliament should decide on the manner in which this integration should take place, but I'm sure we cannot do it without your input. So, could you then provide more specific details on what you mean by with greater integration with regards to Parliament's oversight mechanism? Does this integration refer to commonalities between the different Chapter 9 institutions, or does it refer to common points of inquiry from the portfolio committee? Thank you, Chair.
It's a tough question,
Sasha. No? I want to propose that we all try to answer it. Colleagues, can you all be alert? I'll start by saying that at present, let me be concrete with an example. At present, we report to the Home Affairs Committee, the portfolio one. And as you know, like all portfolio committees, you know them better than us. They have so many other departments that report to them.
Tell us the detail. We don't know at all.
Yeah, well, you don't know. I mean, better than I do. So what happens is that what we would find useful, maybe, is that though we are very diverse as Chapter 9 institutions, we have different responsibilities, we have different mandates, but we all fall under the same umbrella of Chapter 9 institutions, as those institutions that have a particular responsibility and have to be independent. And that is also another emphasis of our independence, which is has to be looked at by a committee. What would be helpful, and I would like my colleagues to add this because it's not something, is to be able to report, supported, supervised by those people who also have not only the compassion of what we do, but the understanding of some of the issues that we deal with in our particular Chapter 9 institutions. Because if you consider that we come here once a year, and then we give a report to the committee that supervises us. They give us, to the best of their ability, their advice, they look at our finances. But in terms of the discussion to add to its debate, like we have just had this morning, which are not just only related to budget, which is important, and accounting for that, but the issues of precisely democracy, I'm now talking particularly of us, the issues we face related to electoral systems in our country. Those are the things that should not be discussed by us only, in my opinion. They should be issues that come, and we are engaging electronic voting, and we engage with those issues with specialized committees that have an interest in those things. So I think this is what, it's not an ideal thing. We don't expect that committee would create 12 committees to, you know, to supervise us on the different Chapter 9 institutions, but we do seek some kind of specialization, if I may use that word. Maybe a committee then that would just concentrate on the work we do, be able to critique it, and be able to focus on it, advise us, guide us, and really what I call and move forward constructive challenge also for us in these institutions. I don't know if my colleagues might want to add on this, but we think this would be very helpful to us. And maybe the committees would, the people who were gender commission, human rights, all of us, I don't know how many we are, maybe one committee that has got experts or people with interest in all these areas of Chapter 9, that might be one, maybe one committee then to have the overall responsibility of all Chapter 9 institutions, in spite of the different mandates. I don't think that would be. I'm just talking aloud, but
there are no simple answers, and we all know this, right? And that's why we're asking, and I think you've been very honest, that there has been an absence of a focus, not also specialization, a focus on the work of your body, right? And, you know, there are no easy answers. That's why Ms. Massimona is saying, what's your view? You say leave it to Parliament, but we're actually having a dialogue, isn't it? Does anybody else like to add to that from your side then? Well, can I ask you then, to that, you say on page 19 that whenever you have submitted changes in legislation to Parliament, hardly any changes were made before its adoption. Is this not that a sign that the National Assembly is not fulfilling its oversight role? Obviously, it listens to the executive also. But there's an oversight role in relation to you. Do you not think that, please be candid about this, because that's our job. One of the some reference is Parliament performing its oversight role. So Ms. Matsumola may wish to ask supplementary in relation to her question. But is this not a failure that you make proposals, which you are technically competent to do, and Parliament ignores your proposals? Is that a failure on the part of Parliament, page 19?
I don't think so, Chairperson. What normally happens when we propose amendments to legislation, the amendment will be accompanied by a memo which details in very clear terms why we're proposing that amendment. And usually Parliament will agree with us. There's probably just one instance where there wasn't agreement. It's on the issue of voters' role with addresses. That's the one that we were not in agreement with Parliament, but by and large,
but it would be useful in your very comprehensive report, which we're trying elsewhere, would it be useful to say we made a proposal to Parliament for amendment, or a proposal was not accepted? That wouldn't be useful for a full report every year, so the historian could say this is the efficacy of the body. Most of the proposals were accepted, but this was not. We come to other areas too where we say, I'm going to suggest to you that something could be included in the annual report. The other thing might be useful to say this, because also it assists in your independence of your body, right? In asserting that independence. So you agree, your body language says, it might be useful to say, we made this proposal, but because Parliament and the executive is an exception. Okay? That's a suggestion. We will, of course, look at our own report as to what happens to suggestions. Now, please note that on page 23, it's not the Electoral Act, but the Electoral Commission Act provides for the appointment of commissioners, by the way. Small correction, because these are historic records. Well, I hope all the portfolio committees read the reports too, Ms. Matsumola.
Thank you, Chair. This is related to this one. But if your response to question 11, could you just explain the challenges that are faced by independent statutory bodies to further concretize the collaborative vision of this established forum of independent statutory bodies?
Yes, the FISB, on page 29.
Is the FISB now defunct?
Is it now defunct? You are the first body. You see, one of our terms of reference is cooperation, between chapter 9 bodies. You were the first bodies referred to the FISB. That says something, by the way. It's a first attempt, if those who haven't seen this on page 29, to have some kind of organized collaboration. It was voluntary, some fell aside. Now, the question that Ms. Machabola is asking, I'm asking, what's happened to it now? Is it defunct? And is there any formal cooperation with some of the specific projects and deliverables?
The FISB was actually an initiation of the Human Rights Commission, and we were all invited by the Human Rights Commission, who were the secretariats, and it operated at two levels, the commissioner's level and the CEO level, the technical team. One would say ideally it still exists, because the others fell by the wayside, by the Chapter 9 themselves, the four major ones, the IEC, the Human Rights, the Gender Commission, and the Culture, the CRF. Those are the ones that continue in the tradition of FIS, as we call it. We do come together to talk about the matters of mutual interest, joint projects, but the major challenge really is that in terms of budgets, we do not share the same budgets, and so some are not able to come together on projects that we conceptualize together, and so. But we do work together. Those who have a line item on a budget then are able to carry others when we have joint collaboration.
Because you say that the impact difference in the respective sources has helped them able to collaborate.
That's what I mean.
How does the budget interfere with the ability to collaborate?
Because some of the projects have to be funded, and when we conceptualize a project that we want to do together, it is very difficult for them halfway through the budget period to get funding to be able to come on board when we do some of these events. A good example would be the awards that we do together to give South African citizens recognition, those who have played a role in human rights, in gender, in electoral democracy. So when we come together, we find that some are not able to come on board because their budgets are very limited. And so they have to be carried by others, which is really not a comfortable way for people to work together when some have more facilities. We had also anticipated to do joint research projects and a joint newsletter. That was not also possible. But we do what we said we would do is to, when we have our own internal newsletter, then we share information, which we continue to do on email. But it's not the ideal situation that we'd like to have had as Chapter 9.
I just want to find out that in the light of what you have said, will this continue to operate, and do you think that it is really adding value to what you are doing?
We think that it adds value because we would like to see South African citizens seeing Chapter 9 as an entity that entrenches as a joint project of the nation. And so we continue to struggle with it because we believe in it, and we want it to continue.
So, these engagements are informal now?
It's informal because the agreement is informal. It is not negotiated anywhere.
Because we have to follow a mandate, you see, in the office. There is an absence of formal cooperation
with
these bodies, and there are no deliverable outcomes then.
Yes.
Yes, thank you. Well, I have to ask that because that's not a term of reference. We might take that on board. Yes, Jane, are we finishing with that?
Yes, I would like to move to the next.
Well, before you do that, you state your role does not overlap with those other Chapter 9 institutions. But sure, the right to vote contained in the Bill of Rights and its promotion protection must form part of the mandate of both the CGE, the Commission on Gender Equality, and the South African Human Rights Commission. There must be. I mean, this is the basic, everything that we ever fought for, the right to vote. So it's a foundation of the South African Human Rights Commission. How could you say that doesn't overlap then? I will give you one example, the right to vote only. The other issues of the right to disability affects the commission we have in Parliament, that affects the Human Rights Commission and disability. We're going to tackle it very seriously. But that there's an interrelationship in a range of matters. It's a surprise to say that your role does not overlap with other Chapter 9 bodies.
We probably did not phrase it correctly. We're saying that it doesn't overlap insofar as it relates to management of elections.
Thank you very much. Jane, we'll move on, yes.
We're moving on to institutional governance. And in response to question 14, with regards to a gap identified by yourself between the legal prescriptions on the relationship between the Commission and the Chief Executive Officer, the Commission and administrative staff, and the Chief Executive Officer and the administrative staff. I just want to know, firstly, why are you making these distinctions? Because it seems related to the notion that although there are clear lines of authority which are drawn, but in practice they become a bit fuzzy. So how do these interrelationships in the governance structure differ from one another?
Thank you. Yeah. I would ask to answer this question because it's the most difficult one. It's been actually since we started that this is true with other organizations, as a new institution. This has remained very, I think the law is clear, as we have already said, but it's actually in the practice of it. Because of the introduction of a full-time commissioner, who really are policy makers, the people who monitor, who supervise, who guide, appointed by the National Assembly. And on the one hand, then you have the whole area of administration with all the operations and the finances, the responsibility falling on the CEO. Our easy responsibility, of course, as commission people who are part of the commission and commissioners is to appoint the CEO. And then she carries out all administrative aspects. Where there gets to be a problem is where in our situation to describe it is the feeling that because there are those of us who are there on a day-to-day basis, on an hour-to-hour basis, we tend, which is understandable, to want to move into areas of activity. I think that's a better word to use. The area of projects. And rather than try to narrow our activities on a daily basis to policy. And that is where the real, there is a tension. So you have a situation where the staff feel that, you know, we are being, we're all over the place, we are interfering in their program work, when in fact we should be more giving only policy direction. Now, when you say practicality is that there's no way in which I speak from this end where I see that all day you are giving policy and watching policy, it's practically difficult. And if you say there is a workshop, you have a great idea as a commissioner that we must have a workshop, we must have a big conference as we are going to have next week, full of enthusiasm, and you want this conference to be a success. Of course, we have to go to her to say, do you think you can organize the money? Because that's also where, you see, though the idea of a conference might come from. I talk of the practicalities of a day-to-day. Now, the question is, what has the commissioner got to do with organizing an international conference?
But then you want to give ideas. So those are some of the day-to-day problems of governance, not in the in the sense of tension. Staff get irritated sometimes because they don't want us to give instructions. They complain. The commissioner gave instructions. The instructions should come from the CEO. The commissioner had no business to tell me that I have to organize a workshop on political parties. That's not her job. It doesn't fall under her responsibility. Those are some of the day-to-day experiences we have. And they can, in some cases, cause a lot of irritation. And naturally, they can cause a lot of, depending on how, but also some of these things really have to do with our own personalities, I'm afraid, our own attitudes, our own problems of power and authority. So they are also elements, though the law is clear, but in terms of practice, other elements are introduced into it. And what has happened, which is just probably on a lighter note here, is that the CEO and I were both commissioners of the human rights. And I was a part-time commissioner, which also adds another complication. The responsibility of a part-time commissioner is those full-time ones who are there all the time, the full-time ones, and they're probably earning a reasonable good salary. And then you have the part-time commissioners who come. They are just realities that exist. Yes. And then you can say, how do these commissions work? So you keep comparing. The Human Rights Commission, how do we deal with governance? CGE we deal. So amongst ourselves also, because it's really, after all these years, to establish, beside the law, which we understand, I think none of us try to break the law. I think in our practice of it, it's not the law that we break it, but it's really the day-to-day practice of sometimes our enthusiasm, at times, I think, our impatience on things that are activities. And the problem with elections, which we all experience, is that you can't separate policy from operations, because elections are about operations. Elections are not about conceptualizing. You have to get ready for an event. You have to get ready for registration. You can't debate it and intellectualize on it. Things have to move. So there is always a constant overlap that can really create in government attempts. And I'll ask my colleague to add to this, because we debate this amongst ourselves and we keep saying, let's work at it. We sit down and we say, let's it. These are the roles. Don't move from your roles. Stay there. And then you pick up the phone quietly and say, so and so, have you checked this? So you have all those. And this is a reality in our own. And to have your part-time, then you have the delegation of power, which also in governance is always a problem. The delegation of power from the commissioner to CEO, from the CEO to our provincial electoral officers, because we have provinces where there is the ultimate responsibility of managing a province, and all its activities are the responsibilities of a provincial electoral officer who is managing that province. But to also keep to say, this is within my power, this is within my area of work as a provincial electoral officer, but this is not within my responsibility. And then you have to relate to Pretoria, where we are. Things like the media, for instance, can be problematic for us, because the media will want to interview a person on the spot in a province on an issue, and theoretically is that as a chairperson and as a CEO, we are the ones responsible to address the media. But if something is happening middle of the night in Kutsong, and the journalists are there before us, our provincial electoral officer can't say, you know, please call Pretoria and ask them what their comments on the war that was taking place. You know, I'm exaggerating a little bit, but those are serious questions of governance and policy that we experience sometimes in our work.
The most candid answer we've received so far on this exhibit in law. Mr. Sever?
Thank you, Chairperson. The Chairperson explains on this very issue.
more and more I get convinced that organizations that are inclined to using the so-called emotional intelligence instrument in order to maintain cohesion within their organizations, as opposed to simply relying to what Shakespeare calls the seat of your wit, but to try and manage that polarity between the seat of your passions and the seat of your wit, your mind, to the extent that you find this as something that is not straightforward, what is it that you are doing institutionally to ensure that long after you've gone, these sort of tensions are well managed? There are quite a number of authors on this. Daniel Goleman is one. I'm told, Chairperson, that Treasury is calling experts on polarity management to deal with these sorts of things. And I thought perhaps she might want to tell us what is it that they are doing to preserve that as a memory.
Why, after 8 years, you haven't succeeded in doing it? Because that's what you say in your report, yeah?
Yes. And many reasons for it, because you develop a tradition and a way of working, which is sometimes related to styles of leadership. And then the leadership changes. I followed Judge Crislam. We had different styles, we had different CEOs, we had different experience, we came from different disciplines. And that also determines, because in this position one doesn't always follow the law, you use your own experience and your own way where you have been. And then the second round, then you get new teams coming. And then you also get the commission of part-time, full-time, interests and personal and interests of people in the job make a big difference beside the law. At some point, talking about this, we called in the early days Team 2 even, Judge King to come in the early days and assist us to sort this in the beginning, because we had never run a Chapter 9 institution. We didn't know whether we apply all these advices that they will apply to us, because some of them are related for the commercial world and those kinds of things. And so we are continuing to work on it. In fact, we said when we were doing the review of the organization, this is one area that we need again to evaluate and look at it again as to whether we are now ready to actually put functions on a piece of paper and say these are functions as they relate to full-time commissioners. I think for part-time commissioners, maybe a little bit.
And I'll ask Ms. Butts first whether somebody else wants to answer, respond to that. Ms. Butts?
Thank you. It is exactly on the subject, and I'm so glad that Dr. Bomber raised it. And I think that maturity and aspects of personality surely have a very great role to play, as you intimated. I'd like to ask really your assistance in a sense, because you say that at page 33, 14.10, whereas in the law the levels of decision-making and the lines of authority are clear, in practice things become hazy. But now, there's a difficulty elsewhere, not in your commission, which I think seems to function very well. And can you help with this? The view in elsewhere is that, in fact, because the CEO, under the PMFA, reports directly to Treasury, I think they're referring to Section 38 and beyond, the PFMA, whereas that CEO must report to Treasury, for example, on overspend. If Dr. Baum asked you to organize a conference and asked him, do we have the money, and you decide there isn't the money, but you're going to ask the Treasury. And that particular commission feels, but it carries the can. If at the end of the day things go wrong, the commission in that case carries the can, whereas the CEO has the direct power to report to Treasury. They consider that this is a structural problem of conflict between the two laws, in this case the PMFA and its own law. And I'm still trying to get a clear idea from them on exactly what it is they mean when they say there's a direct structural conflict. You clearly do not see such a thing. You say the law is clear, that it's in practice really that it sometimes gets a bit difficult. Yeah.
Thank you.
And you had all purposes.
Is the law very clear? Here, you see, the point. Not only in this much point, if the statute says the commission does this and this and this, and the chief operational officer, chief delivery officer, does that mean it's very clear? Well, Ms. Smith's question.
I think we sort of in a better position than other Chapter 9 institutions, because the other Chapter 9 institutions will have a law that says there shall be the chief executive officer appointed by the commission and shall be the head of administration and be responsible for finance. Fine. So with us, we have that. But in addition to that, we have a law that says there shall be a chief electoral officer. And then it assigns specific statutory functions to the chief electoral officer. So when it comes to electoral operations, for instance, it's very clear what the functions of the chief electoral officer is vis-a-vis the commission. Whereas when you come to other Chapter 9 institutions, the functions of the chief executive officer are not clearly spelled out. He or she derives his or her power from the functions delegated to him or her by the commission. So in that area, I think that is where the problems begin. That is why with us, we don't have problems when it comes to functions of the chief electoral officer as they relate to electoral functions. Our problems are the functions of the chief electoral officer as the chief executive officer. That's where the haziness, that's where we seem to have a little bit of challenge. They're not insurmountable. We work at it, and we have ideas on how we think the commission can function in a way that will assist us as administration in terms of policy and strategy setting, because we need them even in issues of operations. On, for instance, maintenance and compilation of the voters' roll, we've done it in a particular fashion over a period of time, and we feel that we need the commission to give a strategic thinking on, after 10 years, how else can we do it in a way that will make registration accessible to South Africans. So if we can find that balance, I think we can afford.
We will, because there are a number of other questions, where the direct interrelationship between the executive function of the chief electoral officer and the commission, the previous, for example, things like that. We have tea, and I say the chairman has no discretion in the matter, but the fact that the two most important people are women may have helped up to now in this matter. And when it changes, it may not help very much. So therefore, just get your act together. 8 years is long enough. Now, tea. The commission and the friends will have preference, then the members of the committee, and then finally the chair and other hangers-on. Break for 5-10 minutes. Yeah. We have lunch at 12:30, so...
The institutional
What's that?